You might watch the news or your social media feed and think, wow, things are terrible. School shootings, white supremacists, college students are intolerant, ISIS beheading people, North Korea has the bomb. If you think the handbasket we are in is getting closer to hell, not farther, my next guest is here to tell you you're wrong. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker's latest book, Bill Gates says it's his favorite book of all time, is called Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Steven Pinker, welcome.
Thank you.
You write that life on Earth has gotten longer, healthier, richer, safer, happier, freer, smarter, deeper, and more interesting. First of all, what about life in America? Are we on the upswing?
In many ways we are, although we punch below our wealth as far as Western wealthy democracies are concerned. We're definitely toward the top of the scale worldwide, but we don't compare so well to countries like Canada, New Zealand, Switzerland, Netherlands, Norway, Denmark. And I think some of the impression that we have that modern society is getting worse or stagnating comes from the fact that the United States is not such a typical Western democracy in some ways.
As you travel around, do you find people are surprised by your assessment that since pre-Enlightenment days, the last few hundred years, that the world has gotten unquestionably better and better and better?
Yeah, people do push back because that is not necessarily the impression that you get by consuming news, because news is about the terrible events that still occur. It's about the wars, about the terrorist attacks, about the shootings, about the pockets of poverty. The things that have gone right tend to unfold on a slow time scale. They're gradual. You never see a headline that says 138,000 people escaped from extreme poverty yesterday,
yes,
even though that headline could have run every day for the last 25 years. But because it is a gradual development, as most good things are, because good things aren't built in a day, they tend to fall below the radar of the news, whereas things that go wrong can go wrong in a hurry, and they are covered in the news.
I'm in the news media. Why do you think the news media needs to tell a sky is falling story so much?
Partly because it speaks to a feature of human nature, namely our hunger for information about what can go wrong. We consume tragedies and crime dramas and mafia movies and war flicks. And there is a feature of the human mind that is especially attuned to what goes wrong. We dread losses more than we look forward to gains. And the news speaks to that need for warnings about what can go wrong, which then opens a marketplace for prophets and curmudgeons and Jeremiahs to remind us of hazards that we may have overlooked.
How should I consume media then, and social media now too, knowing that there's a bias that way?
Partly it's not to get all your information about the world from the news, namely what happened yesterday or what happened 5 minutes ago, but to also read narratives about the trajectory of the world over a span of years as opposed to days or minutes.
So it's okay to ignore the day-to-day news? Because to some people, that's burying your head in the sand.
Not ignore, but just don't let it be the exclusive portal on the world.
Okay.
You shouldn't ignore anything that's that significant. But if you allow it to monopolize your picture of the world, then you can get a seriously distorted picture. Because not everything goes wrong everywhere always.
Yes.
Among the things that happen is that people solve problems.
Psychologist Steven Pinker, his latest book is Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. The scientific revolution has brought us disease cures, as you've said, but also weapons of mass destruction. Did you hurry to get your book done before there's a nuclear war or a massive bioterrorist attack to point the other direction?
I don't think a massive bioterrorist attack is going to happen for a number of reasons. It's not so easy to mount a massive bioterrorist attack, and not even that attractive, because terrorists like instant theater, people slowly getting sick and coughing on each other, just doesn't make for the kind of headlines that a serious terrorist wants. I think the threat of nuclear war is something that we should take seriously, but the world has survived half-mad despots with nukes before. This doesn't mean that we should take it lightly. Quite the contrary. What it means is we should not give up and assume that we're doomed. That's the fatalistic vision that I want to speak against, because I think that it numbs people and it leads to the feeling, well, since humanity is screwed anyway, we should just enjoy ourselves and be good to our children, because there's no hope for saving the world.
I'm asking because you're giving credit to the Age of Enlightenment, and I just want to make sure, will the Industrial Revolution and scientific progress still look worth it if there are millions of global warming refugees and species die-offs and weapons of mass destruction are wiping people out? Yes, the species will survive. The species survived medieval religious wars, too. But will the Enlightenment look like such a complete success story?
Well, the Enlightenment ideal is that you solve problems when they occur, and you're assuming that the Enlightenment will fail in that that one big problem, namely climate change, will not be solved. Of course, we do have to decide to solve it. It's not going to solve itself. What's essential is that we do treat it as a problem to be solved rather than assuming that the planet is cooked and living with business as usual.
And isn't that what you're getting at in your book, that you're making the case for the powers of the tools that we have, science and reason and humanism, so that we don't despair, so that we keep using those tools?
Exactly. But absolutely, that we put human flourishing as the primary goal. What do we do that gives people long, healthy, happy, stimulating lives, and use our ingenuity to bring that about?
You know, you write about how tribalism and war used to be considered glorious, and we've improved on that, I guess. But has that instinct gone away permanently, or is that human biology that we can only resist for so long?
I think it is rooted in human biology, but other things are rooted in human biology as well, such as problem solving, such as language that allows us to share ideas, such as empathy for the well-being of other people, such as the moral norms that govern what a decent person can or cannot do. And so it's not a question of whether particular dark elements of human nature, such as dominance and revenge and glory and tribalism, are bound to have the upper hand at all points in history. The question is, how well will they fare against the, what I call, stealing from Abraham Lincoln, the better angels of our nature, the other sides of you. And just looking at changes in norms, such as the glorification of war, there has been an enormous change. That prior to World War I, many artists and intellectuals and statesmen said that war is not something that you do as a last resort in order to accomplish something that can't be accomplished any other way. War is itself worthy.
Noble.
Spiritual.
Yes, really. Spiritual.
Peace was tantamount to consumerism and selfishness and effeminacy and decadence and degeneration. And you needed a good war to keep people healthy and vigorous. So that was an idea. It was an idea that tapped into some of our competitive and violent impulses. But it was an idea, and it was an idea that was dashed on the rocks by the carnage of World War I.
But do you see it still lying on the rocks, or do you look around at modern 2018 tribalism and white supremacy and think, well, maybe there's a resurgence?
Well, there can be a resurgence, certainly, of tribalism, and we see that in white supremacist movements. We see that in some of the nativist movements in Eastern Europe and in the United States, the anti-immigrant movements. Although you don't see romantic militarism much. There are very few leaders, even in the Trump administration or in Eastern Europe, who say that war is spiritual and heroic and holy and manly and thrilling.
Trump's military parade is not quite that.
They're not that. That's an idea that has gone away. I mean, nothing guarantees that it won't come back, but that is one idea that has not come back.
You said that life has gotten longer, healthier, richer, safer, more interesting. How do you know life has gotten more interesting over hundreds of years?
The most direct way is that the general social survey asks people, how interesting is life? They just blurt it out. And if you look at the curve of how interesting people say their lives are, it's gone upward.
And I suppose we have the leisure time to pursue hobbies more than ever, or I suppose to just work constantly, but we have that time. Less drudgery.
Less drudgery thanks to labor-saving devices and a shrinking work week, and as a result, more leisure time to explore all of these wonders that are available to us. Even things like how many food items are available in a supermarket has just shot up over the decades. So life is getting, you know, there's the supposed Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times.
Uh-huh.
Turns out it isn't really a Chinese curse, but it's a good story. It shows that what makes life interesting doesn't necessarily make life happier.
Steven Pinker is the author of the book Enlightenment Now. What will future generations say was the 21st century misery that got better in the 22nd?
Possibly the fate of animals, that factory farming might be seen as a great crime, that our descendants may look back on the way we look back on slavery. Possibly incarceration. Maybe there are more effective ways of deterring people from aggression than locking them up for years.
I sometimes read your book as saying, don't be so upset, don't be so gloomy. But are you saying that we ought to be upset and gloomy about incarceration and animal slavery?
Well, not gloomy, but take an attitude of recognizing problems, recognizing suffering, and figuring out ways to alleviate the suffering with the confidence that our ancestors did it in the past. Progress has occurred.
Is there progress without upset?
Maybe not. And this is the point of the book is not to get upset. The point is to recognize that people who got upset in the past actually succeeded in improving things.
So you're not saying don't be upset either. You're just saying problems have solutions.
That's right. Don't just be upset, because simply being upset is not enough to solve a problem. It may make you feel noble that that the weight of the world is on your shoulders and you're weeping with everyone. That doesn't make anyone any better off. The upset has to motivate analyzing the problem and coming up with solutions and implementing the solutions.
Speaking of being upset, may I bounce a theory off of you?
Sure.
I'm curious what you think. I hope that we are going to have more peace of mind in 100 years because we will have learned not to take our thoughts so seriously. And I see a wave of writers, and you've touched on this yourself. There's a growing skepticism of the thoughts that make us anxious and depressed. Do you see any progress on that inner front?
Well, I hope we do see progress in that front, because one of the byproducts of becoming more aware of the world's problems is that we add them to our worry list. The question is, how do we balance a constructive awareness of the world's problems without worrying ourselves to death? And quite possibly becoming more aware of our own thought processes, whether it be through mindfulness or cognitive behavior therapy, or just taking in lessons from wise people on how to lead a balanced life, that is, I think, is indeed going to be essential to being a well-informed, conscientious person in the 21st century.
I want to underline that. Cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness are telling us to notice but not become attached to the thoughts that can make us anxious and neurotic and worried if we attach to these. How much potential do you think that has to change our outlook?
I wish I knew, and I can't brag that they've reduced my own background level of anxiety, constantly buzzing in the background, but I sure hope that they're effective.
You're making your neurosis work for you, at least.
Maybe, yes.
Okay, so Steven Pinker, life has improved since the Middle Ages. Can't we take that for granted? I mean, is there anything wrong with being upset about even a little oppression and injustice, even if we're irrational about it?
Yeah. And by the way, not just since the Middle Ages. I mean, just in recent decades, too.
Yeah, true.
Well, what's essential is not just to be aware of the world's problems and suffering, because you can draw the conclusion that suffering is the lot of humankind, that we're born into tragedy, that we simply have to endure it, that we have to turn it into great art. But the mindset that I'm encouraging is, well, you can do more than that. You can try to understand the causes of the suffering and try to alleviate them. That's obviously what the great medical pioneers did. They did not accept smallpox as a scourge visited on us by God or as an essential part of the human tragedy. They said, well, what causes smallpox? And how can we prevent it? How can we cure it? How can we wipe it off the face of the earth? And they succeeded. And so it's not enough to be aware of suffering. You morally, what really counts is not just allowing it to make you feel sad and depressed and morose, but to figure out how to solve the problems.
I believe you were a teenaged anarchist.
Briefly, yes. I was cured of that.
Did teenage Steven Pinker believe in human progress?
You know, I'm not even sure that young adult Steven Pinker was so confident about human progress.
So you've come to some of this wisdom a little later in life. I wondered because I know some millennials who seem to be more pessimistic than you are.
Yes, and again, I guess cured of this pessimism by looking at facts, looking at the data, and being reminded of some accomplishments that we do tend to take for granted, even some mundane gifts of modernity that when you know a little history, you just realize how stupendous they are. And I list a few of them on the second page of the book. You know, we can flick a lever and we get clean water coming out. I mean, our ancestors would have, you know, killed for that gift. Flick another lever and our waste goes away and we don't even think about it. We can say the nastiest things about the President of the United States without worrying about having being thrown in jail, a gift that people in many countries now don't enjoy.
Do you think the average American felt happier and with more peace of mind 100 years ago than if you were to ask that today?
We don't know 100 years ago. We do know 70 years ago. And the United States, which is something of an outlier when it comes to Western democracies, has had a pretty constant level of happiness since the late 1940s. Most other countries, 85% of countries, have gotten happier over the last 40 years. The United States is not one of them.
Why is that?
No one really knows. One reason may be that there are, the same time as we've enjoyed all these material improvements, there are existential anxieties that other nations do a better job at alleviating than our country does.
Like what?
Well, universal health care, a stronger social safety net. So Americans still have to worry that if they come down with an injury or an illness, it would lead to total devastation. And that's less of a worry in countries that have a stronger safety net. That might be one reason. The other is that Americans may have become more disillusioned from a kind of a high point in the 1950s, where America just seemed invincible, a shining city on the hill, before we became aware of things like racial injustice and women being oppressed and poverty and foreign policy fiascos.
So becoming enlightened can sometimes make us aware of less than pleasant aspects of life.
Yes, and that is one of the paradoxes that I explored in the chapter on happiness, the fact that as you do become more enlightened, part of that is becoming more aware of the problems that occur, the challenge then being, how do you prevent that from ruining your own happiness?
This is not a self-help book, Steven Pinker, Enlightenment Now, but any advice? What's something I listening can do, knowing what you know?
To have an appreciation of the world that's a little more informed by data and numbers rather than anecdotes and images. So if you're thinking about how awful terrorism is, find out how much terrorism there was just a few years ago. And if you can find that and look that up, you see terrorism was pretty bad in the 70s when you had these secessionist groups and Marxist groups. You had the IRA, you had the Basque terrorists, Symbionese Liberation Army in the United States. There's a lot of terrorism back then, too. You appreciate that first with numbers, but also with a little bit of historical context. And I think our journalistic culture, our intellectual culture, should ground the events in the present in a bit of more historical context. I mean, not going back hundreds of years, just going back a couple of decades within the memories of people who are alive today. There are a lot of problems today, but there are a lot of things that sucked in the 1970s, too.
And I would take that insight, that awareness, and do or think what with it?
That problems are solvable, that solutions create new problems, but those problems are solvable in their turn. And our predecessors saw problems and solved them, and that gives us an imperative to solve the current problems, emboldened by the knowledge that solutions are available if we apply our ingenuity and our resolve to solve them.
What's the alternative? What does a lack of that faith, what trouble does that bring about?
Oh, two kinds of trouble. One of them is fatalism, helplessness. We're doomed. The planet is cooked. So enjoy life while you can, because it's not going to last. That is a danger, because it can be self-fulfilling. If you really think that problems can't be solved, well, of course you're not going to try to solve them. And the other is radicalism, That is, if you think that our country is so decadent and degenerate and everything is failing and none of our institutions are working and we're just spiraling downhill, then you might be receptive to calls to raise our institutions to the ground, to smash the machine, to burn the empire down, to empower a charismatic politician who promises only I can solve it, on the assumption that things are couldn't be worse than they are now, left to their own devices.
So blow it up.
Blow it up, and anything that rises out of the ashes has got to be better. Now, that is a pathway to disaster. We know that because when it's been tried, such as in Bolshevik Russia, in Maoist China, in some ways in Venezuela today, things can get much worse than you think.
Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, his latest book is called Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Please come see us again. Thank you.
Thank you.